Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. High stakes and at the brink, a possible breakthrough as Senate Democrats and Republicans may be moving toward agreement on avoiding a first ever default on the federal debt. Then, Ethiopia in crisis. Children in its northern region of Tigray are suffering as the ongoing civil war exacerbates widespread food shortages. And biting back, how scientists are using genetically modified mosquitoes to combat the spread of deadly diseases.
If we can introduce another tool that, you know, is cost effective and works very well, then that's something that we're really hoping that this trial will show.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. There is a new offer on the table tonight, a potential pathway out of the impasse between congressional Democrats and Republicans over raising the federal debt limit. The consequences of a default would be severe. But will this new offer get any traction? Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins begins there.
At the Capitol, a dizzying day. After weeks of impasse and increased concern over the debt ceiling, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell told Democrats he could agree to two tailored ways to raise the debt ceiling. Option one, he wrote, Republicans would help expedite a long-term increase if done through the budget reconciliation process, which takes 51 votes. Or two, Republicans would allow a short-term extension into December if done by the normal 60-vote process. This after another similarly vertiginous day on Wall Street, where earlier Goldman Sachs warned its clients there was a real risk that Congress would miss the debt ceiling deadline approaching in the next 2 weeks. And the Pentagon expressed concern as well. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin warned today that a default would seriously harm service members and risk retiree benefits.
It's a meteor headed to crash into our economy. We should all want to stop it.
President Biden, for his part, again stressed this is dire. Meeting with banking and other business leaders, he laid out a worst-case scenario.
Social Security benefits will stop. Salaries to service members will stop. Benefits to veterans will stop, and much more.
But the focus today was on McConnell and Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer. While they negotiated in the afternoon in private, publicly in the morning, the rhetoric had been barbed.
Even now, while the Democratic leader complains that he's short on time, he continues to waste time with partisan stunts that are dead on arrival.
Republican obstruction on the debt ceiling over the last few weeks has been reckless.
But by late afternoon, a seeming breakthrough. Democrats met and told reporters they will take McConnell's offer of a short-term extension. Good news for many holding their breath, like on Wall Street, and for those worried about another nuclear procedural fight in the Senate, after President Biden offered this possible solution last night.
Are Democrats considering using a nuclear option to raise the debt limit? Using a carve-out with the filibuster to raise the debt limit?
Well, I think that's a real possibility.
In other words, that Democrats change the filibuster rules for just the debt ceiling to require 50, not 60 votes. But that would have meant more pressure on and more pressure around Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. At the end of a whirlwind day at the Capitol, a whirlwind solution to the debt crisis is in the air, but allows for another potential crisis in just weeks.
And Lisa joins me now here in the studio. Lisa, you said it right, a dizzying day. So tell us, where does this stand? Have they averted a crisis over the debt ceiling or not?
Here is the word. We're in a strange moment right now, Judy. Neither Senate leader Chuck Schumer nor Republican leader Mitch McConnell have publicly said anything about this deal. But behind the scenes, all of us are getting reporting, and I've got reporting from both sides saying they are nearing this agreement, in fact. And here are the details of what is on the table, where we think they are going right now. So let's look at this. This is the deal that Senator McConnell proposed. It would set a specific dollar amount for the debt ceiling to reach, and that dollar amount would also coincide roughly with some time in December. So essentially, it would give about a month or two, a little over a month, 2 months of grace period here. And then important to this is that under this deal, it would require 60 votes in the Senate. It would be that sort of normal process where a filibuster would be allowed. which means, of course, that 10 Republicans would be needed. Speaking to Republicans in all corners of the party in the Senate, they believe that will be possible, that essentially Senator McConnell has given them the ability to do this by saying it's a temporary deal only. Of course, what this also means is that this entire debt ceiling fight would be kicked down the curb just till December. We're going to get to that later, but let's talk about tonight some more. Something else that would need to happen as we're seeing details being worked out tonight between the two leaders in the Senate, the House would, of course, have to pass this as well. The House is out of session right now. I do not think they would come back this week. They've told members they would give them 3 days' notice, so the House would likely come back next week. All of this, of course, is happening as the markets have been waiting. We saw the markets react very well to this today. And I should also mention, our debt right now is at $28 trillion. So in the air is also a larger conversation about the debt itself. But this was a crisis, and there is hope tonight that the crisis will be averted in the next day or two.
But we don't know what that next number would be that they would set for December.
No, that's right. And it's going to be a very important point of fact, because part of this battle is all about that larger reconciliation bill. How large will that be? How much debt will that incur, if any? And sort of Republicans trying to build up some ads, perhaps, for next year, say, and look at how much the Democrats raise the debt. I think if they do a number short term, Democrats are not necessarily going to want to do that again.
A lot of speculation about why Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, did this. Why did he make this offer? We saw former President Trump today accusing him of caving. But what are you learning from people you talk to?
This is my reporting. There were a few things in play here for Senator McConnell. One, I believe he calculated that Senator Schumer, in one of their first real face-offs together, was going to back off first. It went the other way. Democrats really stood up and called out Republicans, saying, we believe you are to blame. Then also the business pressure that we saw today, obviously real problems on Wall Street, real concern quickly. That is something that Republicans were hearing a lot from constituents and from donors, as well as business groups. Then thirdly, the filibuster. I'm told by people who were in the room and were staff to people in the room that Senator McConnell did not want to try and risk the filibuster over this issue. He was worried that could open up other issues, perhaps voting rights, something that he's concerned about. If Senators Manchin and Sinema broke on this, maybe they would break on other things as well.
These rules that they have in the Senate. So, Lisa, you just mentioned this reconciliation bill, this larger so-called social spending bill that the president is negotiating right now, the Build Back Better bill is another name for it. What do we know about where that stands? We keep hearing there have been some coming together.
That's right. It is, in fact, the case that now Democrats are circling around that $2 trillion number, some a bit higher, like $2.5 trillion, some a bit lower, like Senator Manchin, $1.5 trillion. But speaking even on the record today to senators like Debbie Stabenow, who's in leadership, she's committee chairperson, she told me that despite what Joe Manchin has been saying, she does think it is around that higher end of $2 to $2.3 trillion. Those discussions go on. And I think that now raising the debt ceiling, if that discussion is pushed back, it could actually give Democrats more motivation to work a little bit faster, because they will want to pass that larger Biden bill before the debt ceiling comes up again in December. And by the way, also with that December deadline is the government spending deadline in December. So while Democrats have said they want to deal with reconciliation this month, get it done by November, a lot of us have been skeptical if they could. Now this new debt ceiling deadline gives me the harder reason to really push forward and try and figure out reconciliation as soon as possible.
There's a sense that things are piling up here as we head toward the end of the year.
They absolutely are. Hold your breath for Christmas time and Thanksgiving.
We're not ready to face it yet. Lisa Desjardins, thank you.
You're
very
welcome.
Much. For more on the state of play and what is at stake, we hear from Jared Bernstein. He's a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and I spoke with him a short time ago. Jared Bernstein, welcome back to the NewsHour.
Always a pleasure to be here.
So as you and I sit here at the table a little before 5 o'clock in the afternoon, where do things stand with regard to Democrats and Republicans and the debt ceiling?
Well, the debt ceiling has not been raised, and it should be. It should have been already. This should be a joint effort wherein Democrats and Republicans work together to raise the debt ceiling in order to make payments that both of them have already agreed to. I think this is a source of confusion, Judy, sometimes on this issue of the debt ceiling, that somehow it's forward-looking. It has to do with spending that is coming down the pike. That's not what it's about. It's about paying for bills that both sides have already incurred. And that's why 80 times over the past 60 years, the debt ceiling has been increased, in many cases, bipartisanly. And in fact, in the Trump administration, Democrats worked with Republicans to increase the debt ceiling three times. And this was the Trump administration that added $8 trillion to the debt. So it is time for Democrats and Republicans to work together to get this behind us.
So if what the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is offering is a temporary extension, saying, all right, well, we'll go along with extending the debt ceiling, but only for a limited period of time, does that allow you, the president and Democrats, to do what you need to do right now?
Well, I think what we have from the minority leader is a press release at this point. I don't know of a formal offer, so it's a little bit hard to talk about details, and it's the kind of thing you want Chuck Schumer to take the lead on. What we really don't want to see is a complicated two-step process, nothing that kicks the can down the road that says, well, we'll raise it a little now, we'll raise it more later. And the reason for that really gets back to the economics. We have an economy with a robust recovery ongoing, but Delta is still a on the land. The virus is still out there. And this is absolutely no time to be fooling around with the faith and credit of the U.S. government's debt. And that's precisely what this effort unnecessarily does. So again, debts incurred by both parties, hold hands as we've done in the past, work together. We could get this behind us in the next 5 minutes, not in the next 2, 3, 4, 6 months.
But what the minority leader, Senator McConnell, and other Republicans are saying is that this is a Democratic debt, that Democrats
want to
move ahead right now in order to pay for the programs they want to pay.
So let me say that that is factually incorrect, and it's important to get this straight. This is not Democrat debt. It's not necessarily all Republican debt. It's both. And the reason for that is that this has nothing to do with forthcoming spending. It has nothing to do with building back better, the infrastructure plan, the rescue plan. It has nothing to do with new spending. It has everything to do with the stock of debt that both parties have accumulated. And the debt ceiling is simply a line in the sand that says when you hit that, the Treasury can't go out and borrow what it needs to borrow in order to pay bills that both parties have already incurred. This is perfectly analogous to the two of us going out to dinner, which I would very much enjoy. And after dinner, the check comes and we say, no, thanks, we don't want to do that. But one party is doing that. The Republicans are not cooperating with the Democrats, not working together, as Democrats did under the Trump administration, to lift this ceiling quickly and efficiently.
A few other quick questions, Jared Bernstein. Should the Democrats have anticipated that this was going to happen, given that you've got such small margins in the, a small margin in the House and virtually a one-vote margin, literally a one-vote margin in the Senate?
Totally fair question, and one I can answer from the perspective of someone on the inside. We have been working with Republicans from the minute we got here because we foresaw this. This kind of thing you can see coming because you know the inflows and the outflows of revenues and receipts. And so we began trying to make these negotiations occur in a seamless way, just as Democrats worked with Republicans to raise the debt ceiling three times in the Trump administration, an administration that added $8 trillion to the debt. It's not Democrat debt. It's not Republican debt. It's debt that's been incurred by both parties over the years. And we were planning from the very beginning to do this. Now, initially, by the way, initially Republicans wouldn't help us. And we said, OK, get out of the way. We'll do it ourselves. Then they started playing filibuster games. And so it's not just that they're not getting out of the cart and pushing. They're standing in front of the cart.
Two other very quick things. Number one, as you know, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and others are saying it's time to do away with the debt ceiling. What about that? Will President Biden go along with it?
There's very little Janet Yellen economics that I don't agree with, and I would include that view as well. Look, the debt ceiling played a role at one point in time, but it's certainly been weaponized in a way that is really very destructive for the economy. We can even start to see that now in some of the spreads and interest rates that are reflecting some nervousness about this. So there is absolutely no reason for Republicans and Democrats not to work together and get this behind us.
And do away with debt ceilings in the future. Is that what you're saying?
I think that that is a perfectly fine aspiration. I think for now, let's focus on getting this episode behind us. Let's raise the debt ceiling and get back to the business of growing this recovery and legislating the Building Back Better agenda that doesn't just get us to the other side of the crisis, but builds back an economy that's much more beneficial for the middle class.
And just quickly, what's at stake if this doesn't get resolved?
I think it's unthinkable. I mean, Janet Yellen, you mentioned a second ago, used the word catastrophic. Any kind of undermining of U.S. debt, which plays such a fundamental role in global financial markets, would be an economic cataclysm, not just for us, recessionary, not just for us, but for other countries as well. It's unthinkable. And it's something that again, both parties can resolve right away. The idea of tricks and weaponizing and let's do it in parts. No, we should work together tonight to get this done.
Jared Bernstein, who is part of President Biden's Council of Economic Advisors, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Judy.
In the day's other news, the White House announced plans to expand access to rapid COVID-19 tests for use at home. The federal government is also doubling the number of pharmacies providing free testing. The president's COVID coordinator, Jeff Zients, says demand for tests is growing, even as new infections are falling.
Today's billion-dollar investment to further expand testing production puts us on track to quadruple the amount of at-home rapid tests available for Americans by December. So that means we'll have available supply of 200 million rapid at-home tests per month starting in December.
Also today, the Los Angeles City Council approved one of the country's strictest vaccine mandates. Starting next month, it requires proof of full vaccination for anyone entering indoor public spaces, including bars, gyms, restaurants, and sports arenas. Businesses argue that it will be unenforceable. There is word that some of the oil spill off Southern California is starting to break up naturally. A weekend pipeline leak off Huntington Beach spewed up to 126,000 gallons of heavy crude. The Coast Guard says it is being dispersed and pushed down the coast.
What we're seeing right now is the oil that's showing up on the shore and putting in place those protective strategies as a precaution ahead of oil continuing to move in a southerly direction and the oil that already has moved south from the original location of the oil spill.
Officials suspect that a ship's anchor may have damaged the pipeline. This year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry recognizes an environmentally friendly way to build molecules for commercial use with less hazardous waste. Scottish-born David McMillan, based at Princeton University, was honored today along with Benjamin List of Germany. Their discoveries are used in everything from medicines to pesticides. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today over letting a Guantanamo prison detainee question his former CIA contractors about torture. Abu Zubaydah was held at a CIA site in Poland after 9/11. A U.S. Senate report found that he was waterboarded more than 80 times. So far, the Trump and Biden administrations have blocked his requests. In the Philippines, the son and namesake of ex-dictator Ferdinand Marcos filed a run for president next May, triggering protests. Demonstrators burned effigies of both Marcos and current president Rodrigo Duterte, an ally. They accused the late President Marcos of human rights abuses and outright theft.
The Marcoses remain scot-free from jail. They haven't returned all the money that they got from the nation's coffers. And now they are making a comeback in the highest position in the land.
President Duterte is not running again, but his daughter is. Back in this country, the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department moved today to prevent evictions from public housing. It follows the expiration of a nationwide moratorium on all evictions during the pandemic. The new rule calls for giving public housing tenants 30 days' notice. Meanwhile, the Education Department temporarily eased rules on forgiving student loan debt. It could benefit teachers, military members, and other public employees who already made 10 years of payments. Under existing rules, the program helped just 5,500 borrowers since 2007. On Wall Street today, stocks recovered somewhat as hopes rose for a debt ceiling deal in Washington. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 102 points to close at 34,417. The Nasdaq climbed 68 points. The S&P 500 added 17. And a bridge that became part of the classic Winnie the Pooh stories was put up for auction today. The so-called Pooh Sticks Bridge in southern England was built in 1907, replaced in 1999, has since been fully restored. Sealed bids were submitted in advance. Still to come on the NewsHour, some of the nation's largest pharmacies face lawsuits over their role in the opioid crisis. The ongoing war in Tigray, Ethiopia, exacerbates widespread food shortages. How scientists are genetically modifying mosquitoes to combat the spread of deadly diseases, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A closely watched opioids trial began this week in Ohio, the first to go to federal court. The trial focuses on questions of accountability and responsibility for the opioids crisis, which has been connected directly with the deaths of 500,000 Americans. William Brangham is here with the latest.
This trial focuses on four pharmacy chains: CVS, Walmart, Walgreens, and Giant Eagle, and the millions of pain medications that were prescribed through their facilities. Two Ohio counties, Lake and Trumbull, which are both near Cleveland, allege that between 2006 and 2014, these companies recklessly dispensed opioid prescriptions and ignored clear warning signs as people became addicted. Brian Mann covers addiction for NPR, and he's been in Cleveland covering this trial. Brian, thank you so much for being here. Could you just tell us a little bit more, what is the main argument that these counties are making?
Basically, the idea is that under the Controlled Substances Act, federal law requires pharmacies, like other businesses that handle these really risky opioids, to do so super cautiously, to make sure that the pills go to the right people, to look at prescriptions that come in from doctors and think about whether these are proper prescriptions. And what the counties say is that rather than doing that kind of diligence, these companies just kept funneling pills out the door, and that a lot of people got hurt as a consequence. What they're supposed to do is call the Drug Enforcement Administration, call local law enforcement if they feel like that there's a serious sort of drug dealing situation that goes on. And, you know, the pharmacy chains can point to cases where they did do that. But there are also many instances that are already coming forward in this trial where doctors who had really suspicious track records kept sending patients to these pharmacies, and the pills kept going out the door.
So that's, I guess, part of the pharmacy's argument, that we did do some of this, but there, I know that they're pointing the finger elsewhere as well. What's the rest of the argument that they make?
What the pharmacy chains basically say is that the deciders, the decision makers, were elsewhere. One of the attorneys has already come forward for the pharmacy chains and said, look, it's up to the doctors how many pills got distributed, not just here in Lake and Trumbull County, Ohio, but all over the country. Doctors started prescribing more and more of these pills. They say that's not our fault. And so, again, that's what these jurors are going to have to parse out. It's a complicated trial. They're going to have to decide whether these pharmacy chains played some significant role in creating this epidemic, which has killed hundreds of thousands of Americans.
And as you have well reported, continues to this day. I understand that some internal documents from these pharmacy chains have come to light, as well as in your own reporting, you got some internal documents where it seemed employees were raising red flags internally. Can you tell us what those documents showed?
Yeah, this is really troubling. Already at this trial, documents from CVS and Walgreens have been entered into the record that suggests that employees of these pharmacy chains were saying to corporate executives, look, we're worried by what we're seeing. We're not sure that we're doing enough. We think that some orders are coming in that could wind up with these powerful addictive pills being diverted and abused. And I should say that, you know, NPR's own investigative reporting has found pharmacists at Walmart in particular who say over and over. We tried to reach out to corporate executives. We tried to warn them that this was going wrong, and we were silenced or we were ignored.
I know this is still somewhat early days, but you've been watching a lot of this litigation in different jurisdictions around the country for a couple of years now. Do you have a sense, does this seem like a strong case that the counties have that they're making?
On one level, there's sort of a common sense question. How did this make sense? Why, at a time when addiction rates and overdose deaths were surging, why did this just keep happening? At the same time, some of the legal arguments being made here are new. That's why this is a test case that's going to resonate all over the United States. More than 3,000 governments, like Lake and Trumbull County, have filed similar lawsuits saying that these corporations contributed to what's technically called a public nuisance. That's how they're defining this opioid epidemic in legal terms. If these corporations are found liable, they're going to have to pay billions of dollars to help clean up that public nuisance. But again, under civil law, this is still kind of untested territory. So we're just going to have to see. What happens here really is going to be precedent setting.
And lastly, if these counties prevail, what do they say they want this money for?
You know, it's interesting in reporting on this. This is something I try very hard to make clear, that this isn't just legal mumbo jumbo. This isn't just corporations fighting in civil courts. This is life and death stuff. The question of how much money companies may have to pay if they're found liable relates directly to how much drug treatment, addiction treatment, healthcare programs can go on in communities all over the United States. And this is happening in a year when overdose deaths are expected to top 100,000 fatalities for the first time in American history. This is a devastating ongoing crisis. There is not enough addiction treatment out there. And so that's what these counties say. We will put this money, this is them speaking here, they say, we will put this money directly into keeping people alive. And so that's what's on the line here. That's one of the questions being asked, is how much resource and dollars will go out to communities that are seeing this spike in deaths right now.
All right, Brian Mann of National Public Radio, thank you very much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Today, before the United Nations Security Council, the Secretary General criticized the Ethiopian government for recently kicking out UN aid workers. He urged the government to allow aid to flow into the northern region of Tigray, where for almost the past year, Ethiopia and its allies have been fighting an ethnic regional force. And now, a warning from the very beginning of this story. The images are disturbing. Hundreds of thousands in Tigray are starving. And as Nick Schifrin reports, as fighting continues, the very real specter of famine looms.
In Tigray, children are dying.
When you see malnourished children, you will see a very distended abdomen, and you will see some swellings also in the extremity.
Until a few months ago, Dr. Hailoum Kebede was the acting director of Eider University Hospital in Mekele, the capital of Tigray. He shared photos that were taken last month.
The one in a ventilator is unable to breathe properly because he's getting weak and weak. You see a very pronounced head. And the other kid, if he cannot get a continuous supplement, then the kids will die.
Kids are already dying. In the last 3 weeks, Tigray TV, which is run by the Tigrayan government, broadcast these videos from outside Mekele. The children are in rural Tigray, where conditions are even worse. The UN says 400,000 are facing famine. The crisis began late last year when Tigrayan forces who used to run the country attacked a federal outpost. Federal forces and their allies from neighboring Eritrea and the Amhara region waged a scorched earth campaign and occupied parts of Tigray. But in late June, Tigrayan forces pushed federal Ethiopian soldiers out of Tigray. That's when senior U.S. officials say the Ethiopian government and its allies effectively blockaded Tigray. In September, 5 convoys of food entered Tigray. The UN says it is 1/10 of what's needed, and the UN has been blocked from bringing in any fuel or medicine.
Medicine is running out of stock, and we used to give also food and also some supplements. You know, we have around 60 intensive care malnourished children in our hospital. And out of these, six has been died the last week because we don't have anything that we can give them.
Will those other 54 children die?
Yeah, definitely they will die.
So the combination of lack of medical care, most of the health institutions there are inoperable, and lack of food will mean that people will start to die.
Last week, the UN's top humanitarian official, Martin Griffiths, sat down with the Associated Press for a rare interview. After it aired, Ethiopia kicked seven UN aid workers out of the country. And UN officials say whenever aid workers arrive, Ethiopian government officials take away their phones and cameras, anything that can record. Kabede was able to speak to us because he now lives in Baltimore.
Is the federal government blocking Tigrayans from sharing these images with the world?
Yes, the government is blocking all communication. The reason is just not to reveal what's happening in Tigray.
Can you hear me?
Over a sketchy Zoom line to Mekele, I spoke with Mulugete Gebriot Berhe.
We're just going to have to be patient, I think, because we lost you for a few minutes there.
He's a former Tigrayan fighter turned academic and UN mediator.
We're seeing the peasants are surviving on, you know, wheats and flowers that they have never used before. Because they have literally nothing to eat. If the world didn't act properly, it could be witnessing another disaster similar to that of 1985 in a very short period of time.
In the 1980s, famine killed a million Ethiopians. It, too, was man-made. And Tigrayans warn this one could be worse.
The encirclement was not 360 degrees as it is today. This time, the siege is a complete siege.
The Ethiopian government accuses Tigrayan military forces of fueling the conflict by sending soldiers from Tigray into neighboring Amhara and Afar and blocking aid delivery. They call Tigrayan forces and their political arm, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front that used to run the country, terrorists. And Human Rights Watch accused Tigrayan forces of killing civilians indiscriminately. Ethiopian Deputy Prime Minister Demeke Mekonnen spoke at last month's UN General Assembly.
In Ethiopia, groups that consider equality as subjugation are making their best effort to create and prolong anarchy. At this stage, we are nearly convinced humanitarian assistance is a pretext for advancing political considerations.
Tigrayan forces admit they've crossed borders, but Berhe, who says he's now a member of what he calls the resistance, is unapologetic.
There is massive mobilization of the people. They're just saying, nobody is going to save us. The world has forgotten us.
And to talk about Tigray, I'm joined by Mark Locock, who until July was the UN's top humanitarian official and was outspoken on Ethiopia. He's now a fellow at the Center for Global Development. Welcome to the NewsHour, Mark Locock. Is the Ethiopian government trying to starve Tigray?
Yes, that's what's happening. And your piece, thank you for doing your piece, because there's not just an attempt to starve 6 million people, but an attempt to cover up what's going on. What we're seeing play out, I think, is potentially the worst famine the world has seen in the 21st century. And everything that you've said in that piece is corroborated by what I'm seeing privately and what I'm hearing from lots of other people who have insight and who are able to extrapolate from the limited information there is about what's really going on in the places we can't see.
You use the word cover up. The Ethiopian government accuses Tigrayan forces of blocking aid and committing abuses in neighboring regions. Are either of those claims true?
One of the things that needs to happen is that the Tigrayans do need to pull back from some of the advanced positions they've taken up. But it is not true that the Tigrayans are trying to blockade. What's happening is that the Ethiopian authorities are running a sophisticated campaign to stop aid getting in by, for example, making it impossible for truck drivers to operate, by setting up checkpoints with official and with militia people, by preventing fuel getting in. And what they're trying to do is starve the population of Tigray into subjugation or out of existence, but to avoid the opprobrium that would still be associated with a deliberate, successful attempt to create a famine taking the lives of millions of people. The Tigrayans desperately want assistance, and it is not being allowed to get into them.
The U.S. is threatening further sanctions on the Ethiopian government. Is Europe doing enough to pressure Prime Minister Abiy?
And I think it would be a good idea for European countries and others, in fact, to stand more clearly behind what the U.S. is doing and work with them and the African Union on the mediation effort led by President Obasanjo. What is in danger of happening is not just a total catastrophe in Tigray, but the disintegration of the whole of the Ethiopian state, the loss of 30 years of development progress, and throwing the whole region into turmoil.
In 10 years of war in Syria, President Bashar al-Assad has evicted three UN aid workers. Last week, in one day, Prime Minister Abiy evicted seven aid workers. How concerned are you, and could it exacerbate the famine?
Well, the reason those people were thrown out was because the Ethiopian authorities did not want them to be able to see what was going on. And it is a very unusual thing, as you've said, to throw people out like that. And the Secretary General of the United Nations has made clear, speaking to the Security Council, that what happened is not acceptable. But we just need to understand why this has happened. It is part of the cover-up. And what that tells us is the Ethiopian authorities do not want the world to see what's going on. And that's why it's so important to keep describing the events that are playing out.
As you said, Secretary General Antonio Guterres this afternoon criticized the Ethiopian government. But he, in fact, has been criticized for not doing enough. Do you believe the UN should be doing more?
Well, I know how hard Antonio Guterres has worked on trying to persuade the Ethiopians that their best interests are served by getting into a mediation and dialogue process. The UN has to do two things always in these circumstances. Firstly, persuade people in power and authority to give them access to people who need help. And secondly, to raise money. Now, in this case, the money is not a problem. There is money available. And so the UN has to keep trying to persuade the Ethiopians that their best interests are served, as well as their legal obligations are best discharged, have to be discharged by letting aid into northern Ethiopia. And I know they will keep working on that.
Do you believe it's possible to pressure Prime Minister Abiy when, at least in the capital, the war is popular, and he and other Ethiopian leaders historically have been much more concerned about domestic politics than international opinion?
Every country has to pay attention to what the wider world thinks. What I think is particularly interesting is how sentiment has swung against the Ethiopian authorities over the last 3 months or so in Africa. The statement we heard from the Kenyan ambassador to the UN basically said to the Ethiopian authorities, you're making a big mistake. You need to step back. You need to allow aid in. You need to get into a dialogue process. And you need to stop listening to those people, those siren voices who are telling you to give war a chance, because war will destroy your country. That's the message from the rest of Africa to the Ethiopian authorities. And ultimately, I think they're going to have to pay attention to those kind of voices.
Mark Lowcock, thank you very much.
A milestone development today in the fight against malaria. The World Health Organization endorsed the widespread use of a vaccine aimed at stemming the effects of malaria, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. An estimated 400,000 people, the majority of them children, die from the parasitic disease each year. The new vaccine, which requires four shots, reduced the number of cases by 30%. Malaria is transmitted by the Anopheles mosquito, making it the most deadly animal on the planet. Miles O'Brien looks at efforts to tackle other diseases carried by a different breed of lethal mosquitoes. In most cases, there are no vaccines and precious few ways to control the mosquito population. His story begins in the Florida Keys, where scientists are testing a way to kill mosquitoes with mosquitoes.
Bud Conlin won't set foot in his Key Largo garden without spraying on mosquito repellent. In June of 2020, he got sick with flu-like symptoms.
You can't move. You are so sore. Your everything aches, including your bones.
Of course, he feared it was COVID, but it turns out he had dengue fever, a tropical viral illness so painful it is commonly called the bone crusher.
Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. It is time limited and you can weather it out. Made me confront my mortality.
He was among about 70 neighbors infected with dengue. The virus has been steadily spreading in the Florida Keys for the past 10 years and now is starting to spike. The culprit is one of the most lethal animals on the planet, a mosquito called Aedes aegypti. Aside from dengue, it is a vector for Zika, chikungunya, and yellow fever.
So as long as we have these mosquitoes in enough numbers for these transmission to occur, that's when we're going to continue seeing these outbreaks.
Andrea Leal is executive director of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District.
We're talking about a mosquito species that here in the Keys represents about 4% of our mosquito collection, so a very small percent of our population. And it's responsible for 100% of our mosquito-borne diseases.
She and her team are fighting a multi-million dollar, multi-front war on these efficient disease spreaders. A fleet of helicopters routinely spreads a bacteria called BTI, which kills mosquito larvae, as well as liquid pesticides that target adults. And on the ground, 35 foot soldiers march door to door on patrol for standing water where the mosquitoes hatch. This ceramics dealer in Key Largo is a frequent stop for mosquito control field inspector Ryan Rodriguez.
Well, this is prime area for them. You got water, you got shade, and it's so damp and humid right now that this is like their good stuff. This is where they like to be.
He adds BTI larvicide to standing water.
I just drop one in there.
That is home to Aedes aegypti larvae.
Standing water is potentially a breeding spot for aegypti, so no matter what it is, it can be in a bottle cap even, you just look in there.
They estimate they have reduced the Aedes aegypti population by 50%.
Don't see any larvae in there.
But that is not nearly enough.
If we can introduce another tool that, you know, is cost effective and works very well, then that's something that we're really hoping that this trial will show.
The trial. After a decade of tribulation, it is finally underway here.
This is our release box. This is where we have our eggs and some of the food.
Entomologist Rajiv Vaidyanathan is director of U.S. programs for Oxitec, a company that produces genetically modified male mosquitoes with a gene lethal to females, which do all the biting.
The male mosquitoes mate with the female mosquitoes, and when those females lay eggs, all of their males will live and their female progeny will die.
Oxitec mosquitoes first flew in the field in Brazil and the Cayman Islands in 2010. The company claims dramatic reductions in the local mosquito population. In Brazil, public health officials are seeing reduced outbreaks of disease. Biochemist Nathan Rose heads regulatory affairs at Oxitec.
We've seen in Brazil a 90% reduction in disease in the areas where we released our mosquitoes against approximately a 50% reduction in other parts of the city where other control measures were potentially being used.
Researchers the world over are watching the high-stakes Oxitec field trials very closely.
What are we looking at in the bucket today?
Kate Hill is a professor of entomology at Purdue University. Climate change, population growth, and travel patterns have put about half of the world's population in harm's way of mosquito-borne diseases.
Human vector contact is increasing. The chance or risk of acquiring an infectious bite from a mosquito is also increasing. And we have a very limited set of tools to control mosquitoes and the diseases that they transmit.
Oxitec's trial here is modest. They are releasing their modified mosquitoes at six locations, mostly to track their flight patterns. A second gene is added to them that makes them fluorescent so they can be spotted under a microscope. The team uses boxes that emit the odor of stinky feet, an Aedes aegypti favorite, as a way of running a real-time mosquito census. Michael Bimler is a research biologist for the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District.
We try to get an idea of how much Aedes aegypti are breeding in a particular area.
Now look at those tiny little things.
So those are fresh born, maybe a day old.
And a mama can produce how many in one set of eggs?
1 to 300.
Wow.
For every female that we kill, we potentially can knock out 42,000.
One female equates to 42,000 mosquitoes? Is that how you do the math? Wow. Yeah. That's the appeal of the Oxitec approach. And while a majority of people here support deploying GMOs for this purpose, the idea has its skeptics, even Bud Conlon.
It would be a great alternative to spraying. You know, so often when we mess with Mother Nature, there can be unintended consequences. But I guess I would say I lean in favor of that rather than spraying a lot of chemicals and having people getting dengue.
If all goes well here, Oxitec will seek EPA approval for nationwide use, hoping its Randy boys with the killer genes can stem this growing threat to human health. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Marathon, Florida.
When most people think of the artist Robert Indiana, they think of the iconic sculpture Love with a tilted O. While his art endures, a new book also sketches a portrait of him as a troubled, isolated artist. Maine Public's Jennifer Rooks has a look for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
Final Haven Island, Maine is an hour and 15 minutes by ferry from the mainland. It is a tight-knit community, home to generations of lobster fishermen and their families. For 40 years, it was also home to one of America's most significant contemporary artists, Robert Indiana. Indiana moved to Vinyl Haven in the early 1970s, fleeing the art scene in New York City, where he felt underappreciated. He bought and moved into an historic building right on Main Street, the Odd Fellows Hall. Renaming it the Star of Hope, Indiana transformed the building into a studio, living space, and museum of sorts.
I don't think it's possible to understand who he was and what his work was about without experiencing it with him in that building. He created what I view as one of the most remarkable artist environments in the United States.
To the public, Robert Indiana was a famous pop artist, the creator of the iconic Love sculpture, one of the best-known pieces of public art in the world. But on Vinyl Haven, to many, Indiana was an outsider who boarded up doors and windows on the Star of Hope.
And it just felt like he was creating a fortress. So this building that was always open to the public, the door was closed, literally. So he was controversial. He was a very controversial man.
Still, no one on Vinyl Haven or elsewhere could have foreseen the controversy and tragedy that surrounded the final years of Robert Indiana's life.
It's just a very sad story.
Portland Press Herald arts reporter Bob Keyes has written a new book about those days, The Isolation Artist, Scandal, Deception, and the Last Days of Robert Indiana. Keyes first interviewed Indiana in 2002, and then a half dozen times or more over the years. He found Indiana to be cagey and challenging, but also charismatic.
In his prime, he was very robust and full of energy, and he had a commanding presence.
Keyes says Robert Indiana always took his calls, until one day in 2016, when Indiana's art dealer rebuffed him. Keyes thought that was odd.
As time went on, people that I know who dealt with Indiana expressed concern that he was being isolated and that maybe some bad things are happening to him in Vinyl Haven.
2 years later, on May 21st, 2018, Keyes learned that Robert Indiana had died, probably just a few days before. Then he learned that a lawsuit had been filed the day before that.
During the course of the evening, while reporting and writing about Indiana's death, I was also reading this incredible lawsuit about how he had been allegedly isolated and how work had been made fraudulently under his name. It was a bombshell in the sense that it was alarming that someone so prominent could be taken advantage of and that his life had unraveled so quickly. But it was equally newsworthy that this man was dead.
Key's book reads like a mystery, with a cast of art dealers, lawyers, caregivers, and assistants, many of whom were treated badly by Indiana, many of whom made a lot of money from their association with him. And his cause of death? Ruled inconclusive by the medical examiner.
I don't believe we'll ever know exactly what happened to him and the precise circumstances of his death. I'm not sure we'll ever know.
So this was Mr. Indiana's living quarters. He lived here. He slept up here.
Meantime, back on Vinyl Haven, Indiana's home is undergoing a rebirth. The Star of Hope is being preserved and renovated. Crews have saved the building structurally, replaced windows and doors, and painted. Eventually, this will be an island center for arts education.
Well, so here's the way we look at it. One of our missions is to celebrate the legacy of the art of Robert Indiana. But the other part that's important to remember is this was not just a place where his art was, or this is not just a place where things were stored. He lived here. He lived on this island for over 40 years, and that meant something to him.
3 years after his death, Indiana's public sculptures are as popular as ever, and galleries and museums continue to exhibit his work. This exhibit of Indiana's Hartley Elegies will be on display at the Farnsworth Museum in Rockland, Maine, until January of 2022.
There's a great richness in his work that I think will continue to appeal to both visitors and artists. For lots of reasons, and that to me is a sign of an artist who really has something to say.
I want people to know that he was a very complicated person, that the problems that he had in his life were of his own making, many of them, but that he didn't deserve what happened to him at the end, that he was badly treated at the end, and that we still haven't necessarily paid him the respects that are due in terms of his artwork.
In fact, despite Indiana's enduring appeal, there has never been a public memorial to him. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jennifer Rooks in Portland, Maine.
It's still such a mystery. And on the NewsHour online, we explore the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn, Michigan, the only museum in the United States dedicated to Arab history, and look at how it is still serving as a critical community space during the pandemic. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.